From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, conjurers, cheats, hustlers, and mechanical marvels, we meet Ricky Jay, one of the greatest living sleight-of-hand artists and a scholar of magic, sideshows, and arcane entertainments. He has a new book called Jay's Journal of Anomalies. He's acted in several of David Mamet's films, including House of Games and The Spanish Prisoner. He co-stars in Mamet's new film, Heist. Later, our film critic John Powers reviews Heist, and language commentator Jeff Nunberg looks at clues linguists are trying to extract from the anthrax letters sent to Tom Daschle and Tom Brokaw. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The Pentagon says it cannot confirm reports that rebel forces in Afghanistan have taken control of the key northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif. U.S. officials say they're encouraged by what they've seen and heard, but are waiting for more details. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Officials here would be delighted if the opposition claims turn out to be true and Mazar-e-Sharif has indeed fallen. U.S. aircraft for several days have been targeting Taliban front lines in an effort to set the stage for an opposition move on the city. Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam, Deputy Operations Director for the Pentagon Joint Staff, says the rebel forces have taken territory away from the Taliban around Mazar-e-Sharif, but whether those moves can be consolidated might be another question.
We don't know enough yet to know what's been taken, will it be held, and then therefore will there be more movement from that. So I think we just need some perspective to see how that will play out.
Stuffelbeam and other Pentagon officials are waiting to see if Taliban troops are retreating from the city or regrouping for a counterattack. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
FBI officials have released a psychological profile of the person they think may have mailed anthrax spores. They say he's a man who may hold grudges. He did not pick his victims randomly. They think he's non-confrontational, lacks people skills, and is familiar with the area around Trenton, New Jersey. Traces of anthrax have been found at four New Jersey post offices. Experts believe the most probable cause is cross-contamination from anthrax spores previously found at the Hamilton, New Jersey post office. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
New Jersey health officials took samples at the 47 small satellite post offices that feed the Hamilton Postal Center. The four offices where traces of anthrax spores were found were in Princeton Borough, Rocky Hill, Jackson Township, and Trenton. No one has come down with skin or inhalation anthrax from these offices, and officials said the risk was so low they were not recommending antibiotics to the mail workers, although many decided to take them prophylactically anyway. Meanwhile, New York City officials said that there was another case of skin anthrax in a mailroom worker at a media organization. The worker developed the lesion on September 23rd and, according to Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, was fully cured. The media organization was not identified, but it was not any of those previously affected. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Italy and Liechtenstein said today they have frozen more bank accounts of people and groups the U.S. has accused of financing terrorism. After the U.S. Treasury published a list of 62 individuals and organizations suspected of links to terrorism on Wednesday, Italy froze seven bank accounts. The economy minister said tonight it now has frozen 13. Prosecutors in Liechtenstein say they've also blocked five accounts. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 20 points, finishing at 96.08. The Nasdaq was up 1 point at 18.28. The S&P 500 was up 2 at 11.20. This is NPR News. World trade ministers have begun a 5-day meeting in the Gulf state of Qatar. Delegates at the 142-nation World Trade Organization are hoping to hammer out differences over a wide range of trade issues. NPR's Kate Seeley is in Doha.
More than 2,600 trade delegates held their first session in Doha amid tight security. The U.S. has dispatched three military ships off the coast of Qatar, concerned about attacks linked to its war on terrorism. At the conference opening, WTO Chief Mike Moore stressed the importance of launching a new round of trade liberalization talks, saying it would benefit everybody. Trade enhances consumer choice. It raises national income, said Moore. Many governments hope a successful gathering in Doha will boost investor confidence and help revive an ailing global economy. But not everyone here believes free trade is the answer. About 50 activists protested the gathering, saying free trade only makes the rich richer and the poor poorer. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Doha.
Energy provider Dynegy agreed today to acquire rival Enron Corporation for about $9.5 billion. Terms of the transaction call for Dynegy to swap a quarter share of its stock for each Enron share. That would value the Houston-based Enron at $10.41 a share. Enron is the nation's largest energy trader, but it's been struggling to overcome a plummeting stock price and credit ratings in the past month. 1 week before its debut, tickets for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone are going faster than any other film this year. Most box office outlets have declined to say how many tickets have been pre-ordered, but a spokeswoman with MovieTickets.com says sales have surpassed the previous record holder. I'm Frank Stacio.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at ADMworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ricky Jay has been called the greatest living sleight-of-hand artist. When he's working with a deck of cards, it's as if he lives in a different dimension than we do, where the laws of physics have been altered. He makes cards disappear and reappear and move to different places in ways that we know are impossible. During a New York run of his one-man show, Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants, the New York Times ran an editorial in praise of him. It's not just what he does that's amazing, it's what he knows. He's a scholar of con games, conjuring, unusual entertainers, and human oddities. Ricky Jay profiles some of these performers in his Journal of Anomalies, which has just been published in book form. He's played some pretty strange and sinister characters in the movies. He co-stars in David Mamet's new movie Heist and was featured in Mamet's earlier films House of Games, The Spanish Prisoner, and State and Main. In the James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies, Ricky Jay played the number two heavy. In Boogie Nights, he played the cameraman who shoots the porno films. My interview with Ricky Jay was recorded in 1998 at the Herps Theater in San Francisco in an event co-sponsored by Fresh Air and City Arts and Lectures of San Francisco. Fresh Air was in town for the annual public radio conference. Before we meet Ricky Jay, let's hear a scene from the David Mamet film House of Games. Lindsay Krauss plays a psychologist who's being introduced to the underworld of con men. Her guide is a con man played by Joe Mantegna. He's brought her to a poker game, but he's just lost a lot of money in this game, and he's accusing Ricky Jay of cheating him.
What the f*** are you doing with a flush?
That big trip's where you come from? Give me the goddamn money.
We lost.
I have gathered that.
And if you think I'm leaving here without that check, you're out of your motherfucking mind.
Hey, look.
I'll look later now. Give me the money.
Okay. Give me a moment, will you?
Because I won that money from you, baby.
I'll give it to you when I get to it. Now, don't get pushy.
Pushy, Jim. Pushy. You don't know what pushy is. Now, give me my $6,000.
Please welcome a man you don't want to play cards with, Ricky Jay.
Now, people might get the impression from that you are just a really sinister figure in the real world. Now, in your act, you are the gentleman con man. when you perform, you have this eloquent language that you use, but we'll get to that a little bit later. Now, why card handling? Your thing is card handling. Why card handling and not sawing women in half or swallowing swords?
I suppose one chooses what they'd like to do with women, and sawing them in half has never struck me as the
No, what you do is surrounded by secrecy. You don't explain how you do the tricks, and magicians on the whole don't explain things. I know you apprenticed two of the people who you consider to be among the greatest in their fields, Di Vernon and Charles Miller. Tell us a little bit about what they did that made you want to follow them.
Well, I think in my mind, they really are the two great sleight of hand artists of the past century. I mean, that's tricky, too. I find these labels awfully tough to deal with, and I don't usually choose to deal with them at all. It's probably safer to say they were just remarkable. And I suppose Vernon is genuinely known as this amazing figure in the art. For one thing, he literally spanned the century. And I wrote a piece about him once in Buzz magazine in Los Angeles, saying that if he had never done magic, he would have been the most amazing man I'd ever met. I mean, this is a fellow who attended the Scopes trial, the famous monkey trial where he cut silhouettes. He made his living, a large portion of his life, cutting silhouettes to allow him to have the time to sit in a room with a deck of cards or a couple of coins and think about sleight of hand. He was always sort of a reluctant performer. And his great pleasure came in really inventing and shaping the pieces, of the art of sleight of hand. Charlie, amazingly enough, was actually a more willing performer, and his venue, at least in the years that I knew him, was largely cruise ships. And not only was he a wonderful sleight of hand man, but he was a very good ballroom dancer. So he was particularly well appreciated on cruise ships.
When you were hanging around with them, did they do things to kind of shock and surprise you? Would they ever do something that you were totally unprepared for, an act of magic inserted into real life?
Boy, not quite. But you do remind, first of all, it's hard to talk about them. They were so different, even though they were great friends and great friends of mine. They were so different. Almost any sentence where I'm trying to put both of them in it is kind of tough for me. But I will tell you a strange thing. My home club when I first came out to Los Angeles from New York was a wonderful place which is still around called McCabe's Guitar Shop, which for, I don't know, probably 30 years now has presented concerts usually of an acoustic nature. And I think I was the first non-music act to ever work it. But for years, traditionally, I would work out my new material there. And one day, I came up with a rather odd premise. And that premise was that I would pretend, well, that I would hypnotize a number of people from the audience and then teach them to do sleights with cards in post-hypnotic suggestion and see what would happen. And this was, as one might imagine, a completely improvisational exercise. Although I stacked the deck, as I will explain a little later. I asked for volunteers, and a number of people raised their hands, and five people came up to the stage. And the first of them was a fellow who you'd expect to find in McCabe's Guitar Shop with kind of long hair, polite fellow, a guy you could have expected to be playing a Doc Watson tune badly. And next to him was a young woman, and then there was a kind of nondescript fellow, maybe about 30 in the center, and another man about the same age, and then a very old man next to him. And I started saying, I'm going to count backwards from 10, and I want you to fall into sleep 10, 9, 8, deeper in sleep. Well, I know nothing about hypnosis. And I guess this is a good time to tell you four of those five people were friends of mine. And the man in the middle, I didn't know at all. And I said, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, sleep. And this fellow in the middle immediately goes out. His head hits his chest, and he's there in a trance. And I'm realizing I've probably done something very bad here. But, you know, how am I going to get out of this? So I now give this post-hypnotic suggestion. You'll all be able to do these manipulations, and I show various stunts with the cards. And I now say, wake up, and when I say this word, whatever the signal word is, you'll be able to do this stunt with cards. And I make a fan for this first man. I decide to use the old man first, and I make a fan of cards for him, a very nice fan, and I hand him the cards and say the word. And he now makes a fan with these cards. And by now, you've gathered that this is, in fact, Di Vernon, who's in his 80s. And the reason that I thought of the story, it was so surprising to me, it was so realistic, that for a second, I believed he had never had cards in his hand. It was quite extraordinary. And he made the perfect shape of cards, but in a way that looked like he'd never done it before, with his hands kind of shaking and drawing the cards out. And I said to him, do you play cards? And he said, no, chess. I play chess. You know, And people, they weren't sure what to do, you know. And okay, so now I give the cards to this woman, and I do a more serious double fan, and I hand her the cards, and she does this just absolutely perfectly. And now the guy in the middle, who knows nothing, is elbowing the other guy. Isn't this great? This is really amazing. And I say to him, now I'd like you. Now I say, do you handle cards, to the fellow I don't know? And he said, oh, all the time. And I'm thinking, well, if he actually does something, this is going to be awful. This is not going to be good. So I do a much harder slide. I do what's called a one-hand riffle shuffle. And I, you know, break the deck and shuffle it with one hand. And this guy just very cockily takes the cards in his hand. And I'm quite stunned. And then he puts them in his hand. And he tries to absolutely mimic this move. And, of course, drops all the cards on the floor, which is the perfect thing to happen. And the audience laughs. And I give the next guy the nudge, meaning get the heat off him. I mean, I don't want this fellow to feel uncomfortable. But it was wonderful the way he absolutely assumed he would be able to do this. I mean... So I now hand them to the next guy, who's another friend of mine, and I say, do you play cards? And he says, no, not really, you know, and do something. And he does something and purposely shoots the cards all over the ground to make the first guy feel a little better, which is, I think, the way it should go. And then the last guy, I ask about doing something, and he said, not cards. And I say, well, do you do anything else? And he said, no, nothing like this at all. And I said, well, maybe you can juggle. And this guy was one of the great jugglers in the world. So this poor guy in the middle was having a very tough time of it. And he asked me if he could go again, you know. Just great. And of course, he dropped the cards all over the floor again. And then I introduced everybody. You know, I introduced the juggler, the other man, and then Vernon. And when I told them who Vernon was, they gave him a standing ovation. But it really was... you know, a wonderfully surprising moment of him making this fan of cards.
We're listening to a 1998 interview with magician and sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay, recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. Ricky Jay co-stars in David Mamet's new film Heist and has a new book called Jay's Journal of Anomalies. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Ricky Jay, a master sleight-of-hand artist and a scholar of magic, con games, and human oddities.
Now, you not only know a lot about cards, you know a lot about the history of con games.
I'm interested, yeah.
Now, in the movie we just saw in House of Games, Joe Mantegna, when he's teaching Lindsay Krauss about cons, he says, people think a confidence game is when you give the con man your trust, but a confidence game starts when the con man gives you his trust. Is that true?
I think it's a lovely subtlety. I've never seen that particular point mentioned by anyone but Mamet. But I think it is a lovely thing, that you want to be able to do that. You want to be able to trust someone. I a couple of times have been interviewed about cons specifically, and the point that comes to me, and it's hardly profound, is that I don't think any of us would want to live in an atmosphere where we couldn't be conned, because we would be so skeptical of everything in life that it would be a horrible way to live. So on some level, we have to do that, and the confidence man, you know, is able to inspire that by acting in kind, you know. It's very important.
Tell us a con game that you find, a con that you find particularly interesting.
Again, it's nice, you know, just your questions are making me think of things, and I'll tell you a story from House of Games. There's a moment in House of Games, I try to make this simple, where Mike Nussbaum, who plays the older con man, wonderful actor, is showing Lindsay a hustle. It's one of a variety of hustles called laying the note, which deal with short change in various ways. And in this particular case, the idea is a man comes over to a cashier, and he says that he wants to send his mother $20 because, you know, she needs it. And I actually think Joey Mantegna says in the film, another wonderful Mamet line, make her your aunt, it sounds more pathetic. Which is just, I don't know. So, And he has a bunch of signals. And so he says, you know what, here, count them out, they're 20. And meanwhile, he's given a $20 bill in return. And when the cashier counts them out, he realizes they're only 19. Meanwhile, you've seen the con man very clearly take the $20 bill and seal it in an envelope. And now the cashier said, you only gave me 19. And the con man takes the 19 singles back. He hands the cashier the envelope with the 20. And he says, I must have left one in the car. Hold on, I'll be back. And the cashier isn't worried because he's a dollar ahead of the transaction at this point. And the con man goes out to his car and never comes back. And when the cashier does open the envelope, where very plainly there was a $20 bill a moment ago, there's only a piece of newspaper. And so he's been conned. And when David wrote his version of this initially, which had nothing to do with an envelope or these bills, there was something, he said to me, how is that? And I said, it's very good. And he said to me, that bad? And I said, well, there's some verisimilitude. Anyway, we had a small problem with that moment, and he asked me if I would come up with a solution. So I was in a difficult position. As someone who loves the con and still have friends who actually make their living laying the note, I didn't want to betray something that they would do. And so as a consultant, I did what I'm often asked to do, which is to think of a method that would be appealing for the context in which it was used, in this case, a film. And I came up with a method of stealing the $20 bill that's shown in the film, and it worked for us in this context. The film came out, it seemed to do well, people liked the scene. About 6 months later, a friend of mine who investigates bunco stuff for the police, sent me a clipping from Denver, which said, a con man arrested, learn technique from House of Games. And so here, I mean, this is an amazing case of art imitating life, imitating art. I mean, I'm purposely using a method that wasn't real, coming up with a method, you know, that I think was original. And putting it in a film, and a man who was an insurance salesman, this is the funny thing, this wasn't a crook, but he saw it and he really liked it and he thought, well, can I do this? And he went out and he did it 8 or 9 times in Denver, and he was only caught, he was never caught in the transaction. Once a woman was explaining what happened to her to a policeman, she said, you know, 2 weeks ago a guy did, there he is! And they ran and grabbed the guy. And I remember sending this clipping to Mamet with a note saying, this is clearly the only practical thing I've ever done in my life.
So what is your code of ethics as someone who knows a lot about con games? It sounds like part of the code is to protect the con men. Would you ever...
I guess I did just imply that, didn't I?
Would you ever run a con on somebody? Have you ever done that?
Would I? Oh, heavens no. No, not I. I have a company which consults on film that's called Deceptive Practices, and our motto on the card, it says Deceptive Practices, and then underneath it says Arcane Knowledge on a Need-to-Know Basis. And that is, in fact, the way that I deal with people in the film world or the theater world or the television world if I'm consulting, which is that if a director has to know how a piece works to shoot it better, I'll tell them unhesitatingly. Well, I'll tell them hesitatingly, but I will tell them. And if they don't have to know, you know, I'm just not interested in the gratuitous exposure of this kind of material at all, so I won't tell them.
No, as I mentioned, you're an expert on the history of really odd and eccentric performers. And you were in a carnival yourself.
That's true.
Briefly, as a barker. And I had asked you to do this on Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you again to just give us a sense of what your rap was.
Oh, the pitch I used?
The pitch, when you were a carnival barker.
Yeah, it's called the ballet, more technically, on the platform. Yeah, I ran a 10-in-1 show for...
What is a 10-in-1 show?
It means 10 attractions under a single tent.
Ah, okay.
So you pay one admission and you get 10 acts. There could be a 5-in-1 or a 10-in-1. I wish you had asked me about this earlier so I could have thought about it, but I have a feeling once I start it'll probably come back. Showtime, Circus Time, See the Magician, the Fireman Appellator, the Girl with the Yellow Elastic Tissue, the Electrode Lady. Yes, the Electrode Lady, at the age of 7, she and her sister were struck by lightning. Her sister died, but she lived to tell the tale. 20,000 volts of electricity through the young girl's body. The doctor said she lived because she was immune to the shock of electricity. See the monster child from Johannesburg, South Africa, the monster child with one head, two bodies, three arms, and four legs. You read about in your leading periodicals. You read about it in the National Enquirer. See Adam and Eve, boy and girl, brother and sister, all in one, one of the world's three living morphidites who will expose itself, not to be rude or vulgar, but to show you one of Mother Nature's curious mistakes. Showtime, Circus Time, Let's Go Be Going. They're all on the inside. They're on the inside.
Did you write that yourself?
No, far from writing it. It's very much part of an oral tradition, including the mispronunciation of words like morphidite for hermaphrodite and curious for curious. And, you know, often, you know, the guys I knew doing the ballet were illiterate, you know, didn't read. I mean, they learned the pitch, they were handed down. And yet, pitches were topical. For instance, what in one year might have been the giant rat of Sumatra during the Vietnam War would become the giant rat of Cambodia, you know. Or, you know, a deformed animal might be presented as having come from near the nuclear testing site in Los Alamos, New Mexico, or later Hershey, Pennsylvania. You know, I mean, that was the one thing I loved about the pitches, is that they would vary depending on topical news.
Now, didn't you do an electric chair act with a woman?
I did, yeah, as part of that carnival. The electric chair was basically a woman sat in a chair, and you would walk up to her and hold an electric light bulb or a fluorescent bulb to various parts of her body, and they would light. And the finale was usually that she would hold out her tongue, and you would light the bulb on her tongue.
And so it would look like she was getting electrified.
Well, it was never really specified. I mean, you know, and then there was another thing that we did with the girl afterwards, which was called the blow-off, which is you then put the girl in a box, and you put her in this box and then take her dress off while she's in the box, approving she has yellow elastic tissue because the box would seem to be too small for her. You would put swords in the box as well. Take them out, then take the dress off, and for an extra 25 or 50 cents, you would allow people to come up. Please come up and look at the box, but realize the lady lives entirely on the proceeds from the box. At which she didn't. By the way, the owner would take far more of the proceeds than he ever gave the girl. And then the sad blow-off, as it was called, is you would come up, and she would, of course, be wearing a bathing suit. You know, so it was, you know, yet another con on top of the con.
So how did she light up when you would hold the light bulb on her?
I'd say that was arcane knowledge on a need-to-know basis.
Ricky Jay recorded in 1998 at the Herps Theater in San Francisco. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Eastside Digital, for the newly remastered CDs Switched on Bach and Well-Tempered Synthesizer by Wendy Carlos, online at hearful.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Thunder and Lightning, Cracking Open the Writer's Craft by Natalie Goldberg, author of Wild Mind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay. He co-stars in David Mamet's new film, Heist. Also, John Powers reviews Heist, and our language commentator, Jeff Nunberg, discusses the clues linguists are looking for in the Brokaw and Daschle anthrax letters.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with magician and sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay. He's also a scholar of con games, conjuring, and unusual entertainments, the subjects of his new book, Jay's Journal of Anomalies. Ricky Jay co-stars in David Mamet's new movie, Heist, and was in Mamet's earlier films, House of Games and The Spanish Prisoner. Our interview was recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco in 1998 at an event co-sponsored by Fresh Air and City Arts and Lectures of San Francisco during the annual Public Radio Conference. You were introduced to magic, I think, by your grandfather when you were a kid. What was his magic act like?
Well, he didn't so much do an act. At times he did. During the Second World War, he did perform for servicemen. He did USO shows, and so I imagine he did an act then, but that's before I was born. He was an amateur in, I think, the best sense of the word. He was a lover of magic, and he was just interested, and he took lessons from, you know, remarkable people, and was a very patient and good teacher, and so it certainly inspired me.
And did he teach you things?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. Very specifically and absolutely. And then not only did he, but he got the great people of the day who were also his friends and his teachers to spend time with me as well.
Like Slidini. Who was Slidini?
Well, Slidini, Quintus Marucci, was an Italian man who lived in the city who did this wonderfully poetic magic and was a wonderfully artistic fellow. I mean, he actually made me in those years. He was a wonderful tailor, and he made suits that were like Spanish toreador outfits, where every flower was dyed by hand and put on with sequins. And these were, and that's what I actually performed in when I was a young boy, 13 or 14. And with penciled-in sideburns. And I suppose when I was about 15 or 16, I realized that I very much wanted to make a cane float in my act. And suddenly it dawned on me that most people in a toreador outfit wouldn't actually have the kind of cane that accompanied a top hat and tailcoat. And that's when I think I really concentrated on cards. But Slidini was wonderful, and he was considered a master of misdirection, of the art I always like to deal with the concept of misdirection positively rather than negatively. The idea was to direct an audience's attention exactly where he wanted it directed. But Slidini was a man who did miracles. He would take a cigarette from someone, a lit cigarette, and clearly break it in half, you know, and show you both halves of the cigarette and roll it between his finger and hand back a perfectly restored cigarette. I mean, it was as close to real magic as you could hope for.
Now, your grandfather presented magic acts sometimes, and one of the people he presented, Theodore Animan, was going to do the famous bullet-catching trick, which I think I've seen Penn and Teller do that, a version of that more recently. But anyways, I think right before your grandfather was going to present him, he committed suicide. Mm-hmm. That must have been pretty upsetting for you. You must have been pretty excited that this was going to happen and everything. And
this actually happened before I was born. In sympathy, I was upset. But
in retrospect.
But on the other hand, Theodore Animan was an incredibly inventive man whose work I read subsequently, and it is a really sad event. How much it actually had to do. He was a very reluctant performer, Animan, and the story was that the bullet catch always had this element of danger, and over the course of performing this over a number of hundreds of years, many magicians had lost their lives. But it's also safe to say that Animan had problems that were not directly related to the bullet catch at all. But he really was a remarkable inventor of the kind of illusion these days that are called mentalism or psychic effects or ESP things, and he was very precocious and very, very clever.
Now, the trick that he did, this bullet catching trick, mm-hmm. where I think you catch the bullet in your mouth or something, or the illusion is that you do. I think you wrote that like 12 magicians were killed in the process of doing that. Do I have that right?
That's a number that's frequently cited. Yeah.
Have you ever been hurt in anything you've done?
Yeah, people shaking my hands too hard. No, I've had nothing vaguely like that.
Now, you're semi-famous for not liking children very much, and for...
Well, I always wondered about an epitaph. I guess we've got it now. I don't know.
And I think you've been known to even end a performance if there were too many children in the audience.
You're not going to tell that story about me killing hundreds of them.
Oh, that story. What is it about children when you are performing that is problematic for you?
I think it's pretty simple. It has nothing to do with the children. It has to do with having an art which I take seriously and which has existed since the beginning of time, written off as an entertainment for 15 minutes at a child's birthday party. It's that simple. That's not what it's about, and it's not what it's about to me, and I don't want any association with it, which doesn't mean that a child can't enjoy a magic show, and it doesn't mean that there aren't people who like to perform magic for children and who do it well. You know, it just means that I'm not interested in it.
Now, what kind of kid were you when you were doing magic? I mean, did...
I was never a child.
I should mention that you had a magician at your bar mitzvah.
Yes.
What was his name? Al
Flasso, yeah.
Yeah, and I think he ran the magic store that you frequented?
But more than ran a magic, Al Flasso was one of the great magicians who ever lived. I mean, this was actually I think I say in Mark Singer's piece, the only kind memory I ever had of my parents was that they told me that Flasso always worked Grossinger's and the Concord. You know, he worked the Catskills all the time, and he was on the Sullivan Show many, many times. This was a great act. And that, you know, he was unavailable to be at the particular, you know, at my bar mitzvah, and they were, you know, conning me, and in fact had hired him, and he came. So that was actually wonderful. But I mean, here's a man who did often perform for children, who was absolutely brilliant, you know. But then again, a good deal of his act was going on a level involving entendres which the children could never begin to understand.
So did he make your yarmulke disappear?
No, but...
Now, did you think you'd be able to make
a living? Sure, you don't want to switch the papers and go to a new page here, Terry.
You can make my notes disappear, probably, too. Yeah. How did you end up in the carnival?
Oh, I ended up in the carnival. I was in my very poor academic career. I was at Cornell, and every year a fair would come to Trumansburg, which was very close to Ithaca. And a bunch of buddies went out to the Trumansburg Fair, and there was a magician performing in this 10-1. And he wasn't very good, and as buddies will do, particularly in those years, they go, oh, show him something, Ricky, show him something, you know, which is terrible. I would never in a million years do this to anyone's act, no matter what level it was on. But this guy picked up on it and started going, yeah, show me something, Ricky, show me. And I just said, no, this is, you know, please continue. I'm very sorry. I apologize for this. And he just wouldn't get off me, you know, show me something, Ricky, show me, you know. And this was a guy with gold lame hair, and So the show finished, and even after the show, the guy came out approaching me again. He just wouldn't let this drop. And at that point, I did take the cards and did something for him, and he was surprised. And he said, if you ever want to come out on the road with me, you know, it'd be, you know, I would love to have you work in the show. And I was, it was a summer, and I was attending bar, in a bar in Ithaca, and doing some sleight of hand behind the bar, and... that was the job description, I might add. Conducting turtle races, all the usual stuff. And I got a call one day from this guy. I mean, he tracked me down to this bar and said that someone had dropped out of the show and would I come join the carnival, which was then in Canandaigua, or one of those little Finger Lake communities, and that's how it actually happened.
We're listening to a 1998 interview with Ricky Jay, recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. Ricky Jay co-stars in David Mamet's new film Heist, and he has a new book called Jay's Journal of Anomalies. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with magician, sleight-of-hand artist, and scholar of human oddities and unusual entertainments, Ricky Jay.
Now, when you started doing magic professionally, I think it was in the 1960s or 70s, and it was during what was in part, you know, like the LSD era. A lot of people in your audience were probably hallucinating while you were performing this sleight of hand stuff. It must have been a pretty strange time, in a way, to be doing magic.
Well, one of the jobs I was doing it professionally quite young, doing TV.
That's true.
And
you
stuff,
were seven, but I think, when you started performing.
In the 60s, I did get a job in the Electric Circus, which was the great psychedelic nightclub in New York in the 60s. And I literally performed sleight of hand in between Ike and Tina Turner and Timothy Leary lecturing on acid. That is true. And I dare say, you know, most of the people who were watching it were blazed out of their minds. And it was a very peculiar experience. I'm not unhappy that I did it, and I cherish the memory.
But they must have just read all of this stuff into what you were doing.
Yeah, it was strange. I mean, I had people throwing punches at me and grabbing rosary beads and running out of the club. And I mean, it ran through the gamut of emotions, sure. Probably it's the experience of my life where I had least to do with the reaction that was in fact happening.
Now, a lot of what you've learned from actually knowing con men. How did you find them?
Well, I guess it was that ad in the New York Times.
You know, exactly. Exactly. I mean, a magician performs, you know where to find them. What about a con man?
No, people who are... I really don't know how to explain that. I mean, you meet people, I want to say with like interests, but I will say that. You meet people with like interests somehow. I mean, you do.
So, but where? I mean, carnivals? How can I find a con man?
Oh, one will find you.
Would I be a good mark? Would I be a good mark, do you think? Are there certain people who are good marks?
It's a difficult question to answer. I think we're all susceptible to being marks unless, as I said before, we're so calloused and so jaded that we trust no one in their lives. I imagine that you are trusting, and so you probably are a good mark. Yeah.
Do you still have to go home and practice?
Yes.
What do you practice?
Well, this particular show that I'm doing, 52 Assistants, requires, there's a level of, you know, skill that I have to keep up with. I mean, that's very specific. I mean, I really, when I'm doing the show, I usually rehearse for a couple of hours in the afternoon and get to the theater a couple of hours early and continue rehearsing just to keep my chops up on the level of material I'm doing in that show, even though I've done it hundreds of times. It feels good to me, by the way. This is nothing where I'm trying to elicit the sympathy of the audience. I mean, I like to rehearse.
Tell me why you, if you could, like why you love the magic of sleight of hand, of card tricks. You make it beautiful.
I suppose I do, you know, I mean, I like to see beautiful illusions done as well with lions and tigers. And I mean, but for me, I guess it's the idea of having the direct relationship with those objects, the idea that, you know, someone could hand one, a deck of cards, a coin, you know, common everyday objects, and that you can create something genuinely interesting with that is something that I always found worked. I mean, I just thought it was really exciting to be able to do that.
Isn't there a part of you that instead of just not telling how you do things really wants to say, this is how I do it, this is how I figured out how to do it? Like, isn't there a part in magicians that would really like to kind of brag about how they do what they do instead of hiding it?
Absolutely is the answer. Absolutely. There are times where you're crying to tell someone, whoa, look what I just, you know, you really want to do that. You absolutely do.
But you can't.
I think you can. You go home and tell your friend, you know, your best friend, you know.
Who's also a magician.
Oh, yeah, clearly that's the implication, right. Who's also a sleight of hand artist. Yeah, this is what happened. Yeah, you really do. And here's another funny thing. There are a number of effects in the panoply of magic where the method is really better than the effect. Where you know, it's something happens. I wish I could give you a good example for radio. but I don't think of one at the moment, where what's happening behind the scenes is 20 times more interesting than what you're actually seeing. And you're dying to say to the audience, boy, if you could just see what, and you really can't. I mean.
Ricky Jay recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco in 1998 in an event co-sponsored by Fresh Air and City Arts and Lectures of San Francisco. Our thanks to Sidney Goldstein of City Arts and Lectures. Ricky Jay has a new book called Jay's Journal of Anomalies. He's co-starred in several of David Mamet's films, including Mamet's new film, Heist. Heist stars another Mamet regular, Rebecca Pidgeon, as well as Gene Hackman and Danny DeVito. Our film critic, John Powers, has a review of this new caper.
A few years ago, I met Ross Thomas, the now-deceased crime novelist whose plot lines were as twisty as a bag full of eels. When I asked how he outlined such Byzantine plots, he laughed and said he never planned anything. He just wrote himself into a corner at the end of each chapter and then figured out a way to escape. If I knew what was going to happen, he said, it would be boring. This same spirit is alive in David Mamet's new movie, Heist. Gene Hackman stars as Joe Moore, a master thief who's so cool, we're told, that when he goes to bed, sheep count him. Joe has a young wife, that's Rebecca Pidgeon, a partner played by Delroy Lindo, and an assistant played by Mamet's stalwart Ricky Jay. Joe and his cronies get caught up in a messy deal with their fence, Bergman, that's Danny DeVito, who insists they pull one final tricky job. Of course, we know that final jobs tend to be fatal, especially in the movies. And this one also comes saddled with Bergman's dumb and obnoxious nephew, Jimmy Silk. He's played by Sam Rockwell, who sports a black caterpillar of a mustache and has bug eyes for Joe's wife. With Jimmy on board, Joe and company set about pulling off the Swiss job, and Mamet begins shuffling motives like a dishonest croupier. This is a caper movie in which every scheme produces its double cross, and each double cross seems to double back on itself. Here, Joe and Bergman jockey for power.
We got it's going to be higher than the estimate.
And half of that is yours.
I told you we're on for the other thing, the Swiss thing.
Why is he telling me that, Mickey, that half of it's mine? I know half of it's mine because you remember me and my crew, we went in there and got it.
I put myself in hock. We went in hock, set up the deal on your say-so.
Well, let's review the bidding. You let me walk in there with my crew, and now you want to stiff me for my money? Mickey!
If it was me.
Yeah, if it was you and if it was me. I owe my crew. I got to get out of town. I got to go.
This other thing, the Swiss thing, I was a publisher. I published the plans.
Why don't you publish the plans?
Yeah, no, I said that's what I would do if I was a publisher. Unfortunately, I'm a thief, so I have to do that thing.
Give me our cut. We work for my crew. We'll do the Swiss job.
Come on, Joe. You're going traveling. What are you gonna do? Play me for a sucker? I give you the money now and you're gone. This other job is set up. You understand my position?
Well, here's mine. We did the job, my partners and me.
I'm your partner. I don't set you up. What do you got, little lambsy divey? I bankroll this job on your say-so.
There's no filmmaker more in love with guy talk than Mamet, whose work is renowned for its arpeggios of profanity and its soaring cadenzas of spite. His way with dialogue has made him one of the major influences on American movies. Mamet invented the pulpy patois that's often attributed to Elmore Leonard or Quentin Tarantino. Where in most movies talk leads to action, with Mamet, action becomes the excuse for talk. And Heist is full of it. Everybody needs money, Bergman says at one point. That's why they call it money. It takes good acting to keep such a tautology from seeming totally absurd. And Heist gets energetic performances from Delroy Lindo and Danny DeVito, who seems born to speak Mamet, and especially Hackman, one of the world's great screen actors, who gives this crazy story an emotional anchor. Sad to say, Mamet has never been kind to his women characters, who tend to be played by his wives. Put kindly, Rebecca Pidgeon is not the babe this movie wants us to think. Instead, she's further evidence that nepotism is often its own punishment. Back when he was being celebrated for such plays as American Buffalo and Glengarry Glen Ross, Mamet's work was all about masculinity, self-delusion, and the seedy cruelty of the American dream. Then, his early films like House of Games and Homicide led him into different but still rich emotional territory. But over the last decade, his work has started to feel dinky, thanks to leaden political films like Oleana, and anachronistic chestnuts like The Winslow Boy. Where House of Games had been a stinging film about the psychology and metaphysics of con games, The Spanish Prisoner was just an empty game. it wasn't about anything. Nor is Heist, in which Mamet stages his robberies with a laziness bordering on disdain. It's as if he's saying, I don't care about this silly Hollywood stuff. But what then does he care about? Although the picture is amusing to watch, it offers nothing but plot twists. And these are only compelling, as they were in Ross Thomas, if pulled off with shamelessly gleeful brio. Here, they just feel perfunctory. Like many artists late in their career, Mamet seems to have run out of ideas, and what he has left is amazing technique. If I had to guess, I'd say that Heist is about Mamet's sense of himself. He clearly sees himself in Joe, a canny old trickster who's always a jump or two ahead of the money men and of the young pups who think they can outflank him. Just as Joe can arrange a robbery so subtle that it flies over Jimmy Silk's head, so Mamet can construct a wisp of a plot that keeps the audience hooked and the studio signing the checks. At the very end, Joe gives a smile that makes no sense at all within the internal logic of the story, but does seem to express Mamet's delight in his own craftsmanship. He's pulled off another heist, this movie.
John Powers is executive editor of the LA Weekly. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg looks for clues in the Anthrax letters. This is Fresh Air. Last week, the FBI asked the public to study the recovered anthrax-laced letters for clues. Linguists have been doing just that since the letters were released. But as our own linguist, Jeff Nunberg, reports, nobody knows what to make of them.
So who sent the letters? Did they come from a member of an Arab terrorist network? Or are they more likely the work of homegrown neo-Nazis or extremists, as stories in the Washington Post and the British Observer reported a couple of days ago? According to some linguists, the clumsy lettering could indicate that the writer grew up using another writing system. I was personally struck by the way the numeral 2 in a couple of the addresses is written like a backwards S. Aha, I thought, that suggests an Arabic or Urdu-speaking writer. Though we call our numerals Arabic, large parts of the Arab world in the Middle East use numerals that are shaped very differently from ours. Their 2 looks like a backwards 7. And other people have suggested that a non-native speaker would also be given to awkward phrases like, this is next, and you die now. But then maybe these details were all designed to throw off investigators, a ruse that Ted Kaczynski delighted in when he was sending out his Unabomber messages. And the language isn't actually that alien. That sentence, you die now, might be adapted from a slightly more colorful utterance that Al Pacino produces as he shoots a hitman in a famous scene from Oliver Stone's 1983 film Scarface. As it happens, that's a cult film in hip-hop circles, a point that could lead the investigation down a very different path. And no one who's ever taught freshman English will be persuaded by the suggestion that there's something notably foreign about the misspelling of penicillin. Then there's the way the date was written, as 09-11-01. In the rest of the world, the day usually precedes the month. I once missed a meeting in France when I foolishly misread the date on the announcement as September 8th rather than August 9th. That suggests that the writer is either an American or somebody who's lived here for a long time. But why 0911 rather than just 911, which is how most Americans would write it? One computer scientist I know pointed out that he always writes dates that way when he's programming so that the sorter will put them in chronological order. He was convinced that the writer must be a programmer, probably one who programs in the Perl computer language. It's an ingenious theory, but the sender could have picked up the habit of writing dates as 09 somewhere else. Maybe he once worked for a credit card company. Meanwhile, the handwriting analysts were busy cooking up theories about the writer's personality. That's no less than you'd expect from a specialty that claims to be able to spot potential embezzlers from the way they cross their T's. A Russian psycholinguist said on an internet discussion list that the writing showed that the sender was a 20 to 25-year-old with a submissive personality and a reclusive lifestyle. A story in the San Francisco Chronicle quoted the director of a handwriting analysis school who said that the downhill slope of the lettering on the envelopes was a sign that the sender was bipolar. He predicted that the letters are likely to reappear during manic episodes and subside in depressive periods. And another handwriting analyst said that the heavy strokes on some of the T's and A's were indications that the sender was self-critical. "This writer is an angry malcontent," she said. As the Chronicle's Nanette Asimov observed, that may be the only conclusion on which there is broad agreement. In a curious way, deducing the origin of the letters is like deducing the origin of the substance they contain. We can know from the writing that all the letters come from the same hand, the same way we can know from the DNA signature that all the anthrax is from the same strain. But things get complicated when we try to reconstruct where they must have come from. There are too many paths, all plausible and all contradictory. It all has the feel of the elaborate deductive puzzles of the classic detective story, complete with red herrings and the sudden twist when the second murder takes place. That isn't surprising, since the modern detective story was a creature of the age of science. We want to believe that no information is ever truly lost. Everything bears the traces of its history. A scratch on a keyhole, the electrostatic charge on some powder, an oddly shaped numeral, the detective who knows how to read them properly can tell exactly how they came about. But that's a genre that usually works better in print than it does in movies, where the crime scene is always cluttered with extraneous noise and objects, and the author can't winnow it down to its significant details. It's only after the fact that the literary lines of the narrative will emerge. Acting on a tip from an informant, the FBI will arrest a 23-year-old Egyptian who's been working at a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey. Or a neo-Nazi programmer from Fresno, a bipolar hip-hop fan who failed freshman English and got an anthrax shot when he was in the Rangers. One way or the other, we'll feel that we should have known it all along.
Jeffrey Nunberg is the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the geeky kid goes to college. We talk with Judd Apatow, the creator of Undeclared, the new Fox TV comedy about a group of college freshmen. Apatow was the executive producer of the high school series Freaks and Geeks. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.